Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with poet Andy Young, whose new collection is The Museum of the Soon to Depart. We'll also hear from Rachel Marsh, whose first middle grade novel is Rougarou Magic. Andy Young is one of New Orleans' most complicated and interesting poets. She's the author of several previous books, All Night It Is Morning, as well as four chapbooks. And she's also teaching the next generation of New Orleans poets at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. Today, we're talking about her new collection, Museum of the Soon to Depart. Andy, welcome back to The Reading Life.
It's so good to be here.
In many ways, this book is a prolonged and beautiful study of grief, which is the great subject right now, as it always has been. So tell us some of the things that were going on in your life to inspire these poems.
Sure. Well, specifically with the grief poems, well, I lost my best friend. She died very suddenly after a bout of the flu. So that was really unexpected. And the first poem in the book is about her, as well as the second. And then I lost my mother.
I know, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, in 2020. So as I was sort of going through reconfiguring the collection, as happens over the years, I'll take some poems out and put something else in. What I was writing, living, really was consumed by that process of my mom's illness and death. So that ended up comprising a lot of these poems, the subject of the poems. But there's also kind of bigger grief, I suppose, with the death of the revolution in Egypt, which was filled with such hope and which was so important to
your family.
To me and my family, yeah, and my friends there. So there's that, and the beginning of the pandemic, we're all in this huge collective grief. So I don't know, those are some of the griefs. There are a lot of griefs, but that was a lot of what was going on then.
How did you come up with the title? At what point in all this did you come up with the title and see how these things cohered?
I was inspired by going to the Museum of Natural History in New York. I'd never been there, and I was just so struck by the idea of, like, a hall of minerals, you know, these kind of groupings of things that were, when they were all together, had a certain power. And I also really love small, strange museums, like the Pharmacy Museum, the House of Dance and Feathers, which I had a poem about that place that was in the book that didn't make it to the final cut, but hopefully the next one. So I had this idea of just sort of thinking about a museum as a container, and then thinking, I was writing a lot about visual art. So thinking about, oh, well, where would I put visual art? And I guess I started thinking about it almost in a physical way of, like, hanging these pieces on the wall. And the grief piece of it is where the other half of the phrase comes in, of the soon to depart. None of us are here for long.
Right. We're all in the Museum of the Soon to Depart.
Yes, we are.
But you know what I'll never forget about the Museum of Natural History? Is that you could hear Margaret Mead's voice there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that exhibit of hers. And all of a sudden, there she is.
There she is.
You know, it's otherworldly, don't you think?
Yes. And it, in a way, it makes her not gone.
Yes.
Which is, I think, the idea when doing these things, right?
So that's why we love them. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're 1 foot in the present, 1 foot in the future. Somebody else will be looking at these, I think.
That's right. We hope.
Many of these poems are set in Egypt, where you have spent so much time, a place that's so dear to you and your family, and a place that also has elaborate funerary monuments and culture around death. And so many of the other poems are set in New Orleans, where we have the same thing, where death is all around us every day. And one of the things you do so beautifully in this book is make that connection between carnival and death. So I wonder if you'd read Ash Wednesday 2020 for us and talk a little bit about that poem.
Yes. Ash Wednesday 2020, Sitges, Catalunya. We slept to the clatter of the sea and rose to search for the weeping drag queens, displaying their mourning behind the king's erect effigy, paraded to the sea and thrown in. Procession of outlandish widowhood, panuelos, black wigs, face nets, a parade of public weeping that we needed, though we couldn't say why. We'd spoken of Italy. The virus was just starting there. As we walked the narrow, sea-wet streets the night before. But mostly we noticed the cobalt blue stitching everything together, painted strips at the base of things. We toasted the blue and the carnival spectacle. A few weeks later, the borders would close. Again, the rich decide who lives.
So you all really experienced the pandemic from abroad first?
Yes.
That must have been so terrifying, Andy.
It was so strange. I think when it was just my daughter and I that went, mm-hmm. and I think at the time it still felt a bit distant. I think it was on the West Coast at that point. And then in Spain, as I say in the poem, everyone there was talking about what was happening in Italy, which is, of course, very close to Spain. But we flew back on Leap Day, and within 2 weeks, everything kind of shut down here. But I think when it became a bit scary is when we got into the airports and we started seeing everyone was starting to mask, and it just looked different. Now we're more used to that. But at the time, it's like, oh, okay, that's happening. It's here. So it was scary, but it was like, It was kind of right before the scary. So it was kind of like, oh, okay, our antenna are up. But, we didn't know how bad it was going to be, of course.
I always think of you as such a citizen of the world because you're always traveling and doing things and thinking about the larger issues writing about them.
So. I try to, yeah.
So it felt that way in this book, really,
for me.
Now, one of the poems seems to me to be the very heart of the section called Archives of Prayer. Mm. And it's a long poem, so I can't ask you to read it, but it is better to pray than to sleep. Mm. And I wonder if you talk about some of the ideas in that poem.
Oh, sure. So that is set during 2013, which at that time, the revolution in Egypt was still going on, and I was living there with my family, and I was teaching at the American University of Cairo, and everyday life was just kind of wild. You never knew if there would be, kind of a protest cutting off your way to work, or sometimes there were protests at the university. Sometimes I was involved in the protest. But everything was just filled with the unexpected. And it was also at the time starting to get scarier. There were some bombs going off. There was a bomb that went off not far from us, and that's in the poem. And we had small kids at the time. So it was that thing of trying to keep everything kind of calm and okay when it wasn't necessarily calm and okay. So the call to prayer in Egypt, of course, anywhere in the Islamic world, you hear it five times. Mm-hmm. And I grew to get used to that being punctuating the days. It was this real kind of steady thing that I knew would happen. So the poem is really going through 24 hours in my life there, punctuated by these calls to prayer. So I have, various things, just commutes and walking through the city and just kind of everyday life going on with the call to prayer in the background, but also an awareness of not only what was going on in Egypt, but also especially in Syria at that time. There were a lot of Syrian refugees, and I was really aware and very troubled by what was happening there. And it felt like things were just getting getting worse in Egypt, too. So there's an ominousness and also kind of maybe a comfort in the prayer.
And talk about the archives of paper.
Oh,
I love that so much.
Oh, the titling,
yes.
That. Okay. So I have the three sections in the book, Display of Grief, the Hall of Pestilence and Unhealed Wounds. And then Archives of Prayer is what I end with. And I hope that's bringing us toward, I mean, I kind of begin in this solo place of mm-hmm. grief that isolates. And I'm working toward and ending with more of a communal identity. Mm-hmm. And prayer for me, one of the things I think of it as is communal.
Uh-huh.
You know, so there's this kind of collective energy going on and kind of different ways to look at what might soothe or comfort.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andy Young, whose new book is The Museum of the Soon to Depart. So there's one more New Orleans poem I would love for you to read for us, and that is The Pharmacy Museum Tour Guide, New Orleans.
Thank you. I will. I have to acknowledge Owen Ever here because it's really, this is the only poem I've ever written. I've written poems, of course, from other personae, but this is the only poem that I've ever written that really came through someone else's voice.
Uh-huh.
Because I saw him as a docent at the Pharmacy Museum. Pharmacy Museum Tour Guide, New Orleans. In the glass cases, you'll see the scarifier, the fleam, the jar of leeches. Note the self-trepanation gadgets, the lead needles with bent tips, pig rib toothbrushes invented by a prisoner. Those globes of liquid in the window front were dyed to warn. Red for epidemic, yellow for yellow fever. Imagine the smells with no sewer system, wigs held on with lard, tar-covered bonfires and cannon shots for the miasma, the spirits afflicting the city. Those red and white stripes on barber poles, bloody rags. Barbers were the ones to lance and amputate. 8th-century Baghdad had pharmacies, and native people here had herbal cures and ceremonies. But the first licensed pharmacy in the U.S. was this one, opened in 1816 by Dr. Louis Joseph Dufio. Customers sat down at that soda fountain and had cocaine in their soda, Coke, or maybe a 7-Up. Lithium takes the ouch out of grouch. Mercury for the raging syphilis. A night with Venus, a lifetime with Mercury. Don't miss the tonsil guillotine with its little tonsil bucket, which made it nice and quick. Overhear the opium tampons. Ladies always let out a sigh when I get to those. Belladonna plaster, Godrey's cordial, laudanum and treacle for the baby. Just like now, people come from far and wide, some visiting, some in town, you know, on business. Around the corner where the Omni Hotel is now, slaves were bought at the biggest auction in the South. Of course you want to see more. Here's the blister beetle, Cantharis, what you might know as Spanish fly. The compounding station behind the curtain was hidden to increase the mystery of the good doctor, who they say even learned a thing or two from the voodoo priestesses next door. Ladies came for potions, too. Love potion number 9, draw him to me, the essence of bend over. And the wealthy had special ways. They liked their pills coated in chocolate or precious metals. So they took their strychnine and liver pills again and again, the gold ball tracing each intestinal canyon. And white ladies liked being a tinge blue, a little salve of Nux Vomica on the diaphragm, all the rage. Or they powdered their skin with the dust of the Morpho butterfly, painted veins on their face for that paler, consumptive look. Those stairs over there? Might they have led to experiments conducted on enslaved bodies? Sit down if you feel faint. Some say they hear muffled screams through the thick wood. Oh, but that's not the tour you signed up for.
But that is a real New Orleans tour, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. Oh, Andy, I love that poem.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Andy Young, whose new poetry collection is Museum of the Soon to Depart. It is such a beautiful book. Andy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Marsh works at the New Orleans Public Library, and she knows where all the good stories are. She's just published her first novel for middle grade readers, Rougarou Magic. Rachel grew up in Baton Rouge, earned her Bachelor of Arts from Tulane University, where she studied English and psychology and minored in Spanish. Then she moved to Boston, where she earned her Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing for Children from Simmons University, which is such a great program for children's writers. She turned to Louisiana for inspiration, of course, for her charming first book, Rougarou Magic. Rachel, welcome to The Reading Life. I'm so happy to meet you.
Thanks. I'm happy to be on the show.
So tell us a little bit more about Rougarou Magic, where it comes from, and how it affects your protagonist of this first book, Feliciana Frugier.
Mm-hmm. So the main story is that, yeah, Feliciana is a Cajun kid who moves up to Boston, and she's having a tough time, so her grandma sends a Rougarou to help her out. But it's a little bit different than maybe the Rougarou legends that you've heard. Typically, the Rougarou is like the boogeyman or a werewolf, but my take is a little more friendly, kind of more like a dog with magical powers.
and a very, well, a little intimidating.
Yeah, he has a scary side. But really, he just wants to be Feliciana's friend and everyone else's friend, too, which causes some friction because Feliciana is not really allowed to have a pet Rougarou. At least she doesn't think she would be if she asked her parents about it.
Well, all's well that ends well. I think we can say that. But one of the problems you're taking on in this book in her life is the problem of mean girls.
Yeah.
The mean girls at her school who call her Mudbug. It's a tough change for her. So talk a little bit about what it was like for you to go back to being that age and feeling those feelings again and bringing them to life.
So one thing I think when my sister was reading the book, she pointed at there's a character named Sophia who isn't the mean girl. She's not the bully. But Feliciana is really worried that she might also be mean because she saw a picture on social media of Sophia with
right.
the bully. And my sister read that and she was like, I can tell that you have a little bit of social anxiety. And it's so true when you're in middle school, it's like that stage of development where you don't necessarily have all of your brain and empathy developed yet, but you feel so under the microscope. You feel like everyone's mm-hmm. looking at you all the time. And I think that really came through with Feliciana at her new school because she has moved to a new school because of her bullying problem. Even though her bully doesn't follow her, that anxiety about that bullying causes does follow her. And so she's slow to open up to people who, turns out, might be good friends because she's worried from her previous experience that that's not going to be the case, that they're going to be a bully just like her bully.
And they both have artistic talent. And
yeah.
They're a little competitive.
Yes,
so that's,
definitely.
You know, it's hard to learn how to do those things sometimes
yes.
near that age. One of the great things about this book is that it loads her up with all these problems, Feliciana, but you never have any doubt that they're problems she can overcome. And you throw in just enough magic. So talk about deciding the right proportion.
Yeah. I really am like a realism writer at heart. I don't know how I ended up in this book with magic. I mean, obviously, I pulled from Cajun folklore. So, you know, while the Rougarou isn't real, those that folklore and the stories that people tell are real stories that people have told for years and years and years. So those quote unquote real stories is where I took the inspiration from Rue. And all along the way, everyone who read it, editors and agents and stuff, were always like, well, what if you put in a little more magic? What if you put in a little more magic? So I listened to their advice. It's good to have a good team of people helping you with your books. And Rue got more and more magical with every draft.
And Rue got an amazing superpower, too, but
yes.
we won't say what that
okay.
was. But it's wonderfully appropriate.
Yes.
I love that so, so much. So I'm curious, did you write the book here in Louisiana, or did you write it in Boston?
I wrote it in Boston. Well, so the way my program, my MFA program, was set up was that each semester we had to write as much of a book as we possibly could. So I was writing it while I was up there, and I was feeling a lot of the same feelings that Feliciana has during the book. They're inspired by real life. You know, I was missing, mm-hmm. my family was here, my then fiance, now husband, was still here in Louisiana. And so I was just feeling very far away from home and from family and my community. And much like Feliciana, I don't like winter. So,
oh no.
Yeah. So those struggles were definitely struggles that I was personally having. But I'm glad that I got to put them into something productive and put them into a book with, mm-hmm. get some meaning behind those feelings.
So many people say the best fiction comes out of a quality of yearning. Mm. Or desire.
There's a lot of yearning here.
And a lot of times people have to leave home to write about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like the idea of it being a Louisiana kid, a Cajun kid somewhere else, because I feel like that's a pretty common experience. You know, mm-hmm. I grew up here, but a lot of my cousins have, you know, moved away and now their kids are growing up somewhere else. Or my friends who have had kids might be living somewhere else and raising their kids in another part of the country. And so it just makes you think about, like, how can you still keep that Louisiana culture and still keep that Cajun culture, even if you aren't geographically here anymore.
So do you want to write more about that? Do you think you will?
I do have a second book in the works. It's not a sequel. It's a standalone book. I don't know how much I'm allowed to say. It's still in progress. I just got my edits from my editor yesterday. But it takes place in New Orleans, and the sort of displacement element is more that the protagonist's family has come to New Orleans from further down the bayou, because mm-hmm. that's a migration that we see too. You know, my mom is from like Chauvin area and I grew up in Baton Rouge, right? So moving to a different part of the state. So that's more of the migration that book two is dealing with, at least in this current draft.
So I'm curious, did you try it out? I mean, you talk about the feedback you got from editors and teachers about, mm-hmm. you know, maybe a little more magic. Did you try it out on any contemporary aged readers?
Like kids.
Yeah.
So the funny thing about the children's lit industry is that they don't really ask kids about it until
I know.
It's already published. But I'm really excited. In a couple of weeks, there's Red Stick Reads in Baton Rouge has a middle school book club. And so I'm going to get to go and like talk to the club of middle schoolers who have all read the book. And I'm really excited to get their feedback about it. Otherwise, you know, I've talked to my neighbors who read it and their kids, and they seem to like it so far.
Well, did you always want to be a writer, or did you think you might be a librarian?
I always wanted to be a writer. It's just kind of been a push and pull throughout my life of like how realistic that goal would be, because obviously in a creative industry, nothing is guaranteed. It's not the kind of thing where you get your degree and off to the office, you definitely have a job. So I am very lucky that it worked out the way it did and that I get to do it for real.
Oh, and it's such a fun book.
Thank you.
It really is. You just root for her all the way.
Good, yeah.
But talk a little bit too about making her an artist, because mm-hmm. I thought that was really important to give her that gift. I mean, you know, they mm-hmm. say you're your fairy godmother for your characters. You can give them anything you want them to have. And that was a great gift.
Yeah.
To give to your character.
So that came out of more grad school advice, which is that you should give your character an interest, and that will be a way for readers to connect with your character. I, unfortunately, cannot draw worth my life, but my sister is a great artist. And so I talked with her a lot about the art scenes, and they're very inspired by our own elementary and middle school art classes at the school where we went. And I was always asking, like, what annoyed you about art class? Or, like, what did you like about art class? Or, like, what were the projects that you remember about art class? So it was great to have someone with Feliciana's lived talents to pick her brain about what it's like to be a good artist in middle school.
Mm-hmm. But to have that conviction at such a young age is so rare and important, I think.
Yeah, and that's, you know, per the advice, that's what makes us as the audience root for her, I think, is because it is like, oh, this is like a special kid. She's interested in something. She's talented at something. It piques your interest.
Well, we've been talking with Rachel Marsh, whose new book is Rougarou Magic, her first book, but not her last. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
what's on tap in the literary life this week. Gypsy Rose Blanchard will be at the Garden District Bookshop Friday, December 13th for an author meet and greet for her memoir, My Time to Stand. The event will begin at 5 at Garden District Bookshop and is a ticketed event. Michelle Dumont, author of a new children's board book titled Phoebe Cakes the Bulldog, A Mardi Gras Tale, will be the featured speaker at the annual Jefferson Parish Children's Book Festival, Saturday, December 14th at 9:30 a.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This event is free of charge and open to the public. Other children's authors on hand include Gary Olipio, Karen Connor, Louis Duet, Laura Roach Dragon, M.H. Hurlong, Leah Eskin, Laura Michaud, Rachel Marsh, Gideon Hodge, and others. Jeanette Weiland signs her new children's book, Alligator Stew, Saturday, December 14th at 11 at Garden District Bookshop. One Book, One New Orleans will launch New Orleans Chronicles, a book inspired by the writings of Mona Lisa Saloy, Saturday, December 14th at 2 at the New Orleans Public Library Main Branch. Elizabeth Serena signs Casket Girls, Monday, December 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.